and welcome to a reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, May 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Reynolds trusts Iowans to use good judgment as state reopens. As the first full week began of many businesses statewide reopening at 50% capacity, Governor Kim Reynolds defended her metrics for reopening and said she trusted Iowans' good judgment in deciding what was best for them. "I've asked everyone to exercise personal responsibility from the very beginning," she said Monday. "Today begins week 11 since COVID-19 was confirmed in Iowa. We're at a point where we can and must strike a balance. Businesses and patrons in the Cedar Valley have been split over whether to reopen or visit a reopened business in person." But Reynolds pointed to the daily case count, which has come down in recent days, and said the state was 18 days removed since its highest case number. The state reached a one-day high of 757 cases on May 2nd. She also said the number of days between Iowa doubling its cases was 21 days, and noted robust testing was occurring, though as of Monday, 14.5% of all tests were positive, more than the WHO recommended 10%. "It's not a matter of prioritizing one over the other," Reynolds said of reopening the economy versus the health of Iowans. "It's prioritizing both." She announced the state would now be updating data throughout the day on coronavirus.iowa.gov instead of once per day. Iowa remained 14th in the nation for cases per capita. It was 24th in deaths per capita. Adding Black Hawk County's totals to the state's 15,182 people in 97 of Iowa's 99 counties have tested positive for coronavirus, or 0.4% of the state's population. Only Decatur and Ringgold counties, neighboring counties along the Missouri border, have no positive cases recorded. There are now 356 deaths in 33 counties and 36 long-term care outbreaks in 15 counties. Around 2.4% of Iowans who have tested positive for coronavirus have died of COVID-19, with 87% over the age of 61. Four counties now report an infection rate over 2%, Crawford, Loisa, Tama, and Woodbury counties. Another four are over 1% of their population, Blackhawk, Marshall, Muscatine, and Wapello counties. Nine counties now had 10 or more COVID-19 deaths, Blackhawk, Dallas, Dubuque, Jasper, Lynn, Muscatine, Polk, Tama, and Woodbury counties. Iowa Department of Public Health Director Dr. Caitlin Padotti confirmed the state had two cases of children contracting what is now known as multi-symptom inflammatory syndrome occurring among children who have had coronavirus. "Both were in eastern Iowa and both were hospitalized," Padotti said, but the state had no further information Monday. Cerro Gordo County added two more cases for a total of 17. The Black Hawk County Health Department reported 1,831 cases and 31 deaths in the county as of Sunday. The county has four long-term care facility outbreaks, with Pillar of Cedar Valley the newest outbreak recorded, with five cases among residents and staff. The others are Harmony House with 85 cases, Friendship Village with 40 cases, and New Aldea Lifescapes with 13 cases. Bremer County added one case for a total of 64 cases and five deaths. Battles Lutheran Retirement Community, which has a state-confirmed coronavirus outbreak, has 31 of the county's cases. Butler County added one case for a total of 14 cases. Floyd County added one case for a total of 11 cases and one death. Hancock County now reports a total of five cases. Kossuth County initially had listed a total of five cases, but Kossuth County Emergency Management announced one case was mistakenly counted twice. The number has been corrected to list four total cases. Hardin County added one case for a total of 12 cases. Tama County added eight cases and two deaths for a total of 358 cases and 17 deaths. The county has two long-term care outbreaks, 52 cases at Pinnacle Estates of Toledo and 31 cases at Westbrook Acres. Winneshiek County added two cases for a total of 20 cases. State confirms first cases of children with COVID-19-linked inflammatory disease. A rare inflammatory syndrome linked to COVID-19 illness in children is now a mandatory reportable illness to state public health officials after a Cedar Rapids hospital confirmed its providers are caring for two young patients with the mysterious illness. Unity Point Health Cedar Rapids confirmed on Monday that it has the state's first reported cases of multi-system inflammatory disorder in children and adolescents. Officials declined to offer more details on these patients, citing privacy concerns. Dr. Caitlin Padatti, state epidemiologist and medical director of the state health department, confirmed during the governor's daily news briefing that the Iowa Department of Public Health had received reports of two cases in eastern Iowa on Friday afternoon. Both patients are in stable condition, Padatti said during the briefing on Monday. In addition to making up a smaller proportion of those infected by COVID-19, most diagnosed children have not developed serious respiratory failure symptoms, as has been observed in adults since the pandemic began. However, late last week, federal public health officials alerted states of a new illness associated with COVID-19 among children. Also known as pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or PMIS, it is a rare, potentially deadly syndrome that has appeared in recent weeks among hundreds of children across the country who have been diagnosed with the novel coronavirus. Unity Point Health Cedar Rapids officials said the illness appears to be a post-viral inflammation of the blood vessels, including the vessels in the heart. The condition can appear anywhere between a few days to a few weeks after COVID-19 infection. The syndrome has been compared to toxic shock syndrome and Kawasaki disease, another rare childhood inflammatory condition that presents with similar symptoms. These two syndromes appear similar in that they both seem to cause what we call post-infectious inflammation, meaning that several weeks after a likely infection, people might develop signs of inflammation throughout the body, said Padatti over video during the governor's briefing. We do think this is a new condition distinct from Kawasaki disease, she added. According to a survey conducted by ABC News, health officials in 20 states and Washington, D.C. are investigating at least 200 confirmed or suspected cases of the syndrome in children thought to have been affected by COVID-19. In New York, at least 3 children have died and more than 100 cases are being monitored, the state health department said. On Monday, Padatti announced it was now mandatory for medical providers and local public health departments to report cases of this new syndrome to the state public health department. Under this mandate, hospitals must report any potential cases to the state. In turn, that information goes back to the local health departments through the Iowa Disease Surveillance System for further investigation. It's unclear how this condition will affect the return to school, but Padatti said public health officials will continue to collaborate with other entities as they gather more information and learn more about this rare condition. According to Unity Point Health Cedar Rapids officials and other public health experts, symptoms of multisystem inflammatory disorder in children and adolescents include persistent fever, conjunctivitis or pink eye, rash, enlarged lymph nodes, swollen hands or feet, abdominal pain without explanation, and vomiting and/or diarrhea. As Iowa reopens, state's coronavirus data remains elusive. For the past 9 weeks, 68-year-old Debbie Buck has been isolating with her husband, Dennis Fett, at their rural home and peacock farm in western Iowa's Pottawatomie County, which has seen its known cases of coronavirus spike over 300% in 2 weeks. For most, if not all, of that time, she has been tuning in to watch Governor Kim Reynolds' nearly daily updates, eagerly awaiting what she perceived as among the most important information: the number of new cases and deaths. At first, Reynolds announced daily COVID-19 cases and deaths by county, including the age ranges of those who became infected or died. As the tallies swelled, Reynolds' office with the Iowa Department of Public Health assigned regional scores as a way of evaluating the pandemic spread, tying the overall score to setting public policies. But then, in early May, Reynolds's reporting practices changed. She stopped announcing daily cases and deaths on TV. She stopped sending out those statistics with news releases to the media and posts to the governor's website. She instead unveiled a new coronavirus.iowa.gov website showing total cases, deaths, and tests on a statewide and county level. It provided statewide demographic data and percentages, but not raw numbers and not by county. The dashboard on the revised website includes a range of other COVID-19 metrics, like number of Iowans who have recovered, percentage of positive tests, and long-term care outbreaks. But while the site provides graphics showing cases and recoveries over time, it does not provide such a timeline graphic for deaths, making it hard for Iowans to easily gauge whether they're rising or falling. The site also fails to provide demographic data by county for cases, recoveries, and deaths, including age range, gender, race, and ethnicity. It provides those demographic details only in statewide percentages, not raw numbers. Without the governor's daily announcement, Buck, scrambling for a way to gauge her state's progress in fighting COVID-19, began keeping her own spreadsheet and doing her own math. "I have to add and subtract and figure out how many deaths there were," she told the Gazette. "I've been keeping my own chart and tally since this new website started." Reynolds' decision to de-emphasize the number of new cases and deaths on television and to stop providing demographic data for communities, including that overall regional score she had pointed to as important in setting policy, comes at a time she is increasing the ability of Iowans to sit down for a meal at a restaurant, get a haircut, work out at a gym, and go shopping. Reynolds said Iowans would need to decide for themselves, taking into account their own circumstances, whether to venture out. "Everybody is going to make their own decisions," she said. "Even though we have eased the mitigation requirements on some of our businesses, restaurants, salons, churches, you still have individual businesses. Some are ready to open up and they're moving forward. Others are continuing to make sure they can do it in a safe and responsible manner. And then Iowans are going to take the responsibility to decide if they are ready to go out and participate at the businesses or go to a restaurant." But Western Iowa's Buck asked, "How can Iowans do that without accessible and consumable information about community spread at the local level? It seems to me she's trying to avoid it, especially the death count, so people don't hear it," she said. "If you don't hear it and don't think about it, it will go away and it will be okay to open up. That concerns me." Addressing concerns about the data being released, Governor's spokesman Pat Garrett praised the timeliness of the revamped website, noting the state is giving Iowans more information than they had before. Instead of updating news conference viewers with numbers that already are a day old, Garrett said the website now provides data as of 11:59 p.m., and the state is working to make it more timely with updates more regularly, he said. "What we are providing is much more timely data than we've ever had before," he said. Nonetheless, that more current data still is available 11 hours before Reynolds goes on live TV. Providing it on the website instead of also on television does not reach Iowans who don't have internet access or familiarity in how to use it. As to removal from its website of regional COVID-19 rankings previously used to assess the severity of the pandemic spread across Iowa, Garrett said that data has lost relevance. With Test Iowa, the state now has the ability to drill down to a county, city, zip code to analyze the spread of the virus and determine mitigation strategies, he said. But the state has not shared that level of local data with the public. Garrett didn't address the Gazette's questions about why the state isn't providing the same data and graphics for deaths as it is for other metrics, or why the governor stopped announcing daily cases and deaths during her TV briefings. After fielding a range of queries from reporters about the data gaps, however, Reynolds opened her news conference Friday in a more familiar fashion, first announcing, "Over the week, we have seen our positive case count stabilize. Today, we are reporting that we have 374 new positive cases and 3,888 negative cases," she said. "Days to double continues to improve. Today it's 18 days, which speaks to the slowing of the spread of the virus." She reported, "Unfortunately, 18 Iowans have lost their lives to COVID-19. In response to media questions earlier in the week, Reynolds asserted that information is not being limited. "We're trying to provide more access to Iowans, and we're trying to do it in a more timely fashion," she said, noting she, too, felt some frustration in navigating the changing website. "Even as I'm trying to manage through the system, it's changed. It's changing daily as we're learning more and trying to provide Iowans with more timely information," Reynolds said. "I like the graphs, but it is changing and it is fluid right now." Iowa Department of Public Health Deputy Director Sarah Reissetter said her department is taking the feedback and making adjustments. "I can tell you that they're actively working to provide some more information," she said. "We're doing it carefully. We're doing it diligently. but we do expect in the next week or so to be able to provide some more functionality. And some of the things that you're referencing that are currently lacking, I would expect to see some of them come back for you. The information is coming late, though, as many previously shuttered parts of Iowa's economy already have blinked back to life, reigniting marketplace competition and putting some business owners in a tight spot, according to Senator Claire Selsey, a Democrat from West Des Moines. "What I've been getting is, why don't they track county-level data anymore?" she said of the feedback she has received from constituents. "If you have a business in Polk County or in Johnson County, you want to know what the data is among your customers," she said. "They're the ones that are going to be frequenting your business." Selsey says lawmakers, like the public, stopped getting the daily case and death totals they relied on, prompting her to reach out to the governor's office for more information. But her follow-up questions have gone unanswered, she said, and it's frustrating. "Nobody's personally blaming Kim Reynolds for the pandemic," she said, "but they are now starting to blame her for any actions moving forward that involve opening up the state without the data to support it. And I think that's where I would hold her." Selsey said she sent emails to the public health department asking for information, arguing, "You guys keep telling us this data is here and it's not." Reynolds has urged Iowans with questions or concerns to call, although there is no clear number for data-related questions on the website dashboard. Senator Joe Bolcom, a Democrat from Iowa City, said he too has concerns about changes in how the state is reporting data. He also has started maintaining his own spreadsheet. "The new dashboard made it really significantly harder for Iowans to track the day-to-day progress of the pandemic, unless you looked at the website yesterday and wrote down the numbers the day before that or the day before that," he said. "It just doesn't make any sense. We're collecting the data. We should make it available to Iowans with an interest in tracking this pandemic." That, according to Bolcom, should include data on testing, which experts and analysts have heralded as paramount to any reopening effort. Although the governor's dashboard shows total testing, county-level testing, and a daily progression of testing in Iowa, it doesn't break down the numbers by type or mode of testing, including how much has been accomplished under the $26 million Test Iowa initiative. Instead, the state's dashboard is providing only the number of Test Iowa assessments Iowans have completed to determine who qualifies for a test. Assuming the state has this information, daily number of tests by type and demographic details at the local level, 69-year-old Dennis Fett, who said he voted for Reynolds, argues the governor should release it. "I don't care if she tells me bad news," he said. "I just want to know it so I can make my own decisions." Virus review. Trump says he's taking unproven drug. Auto workers return to factories. President Donald Trump said Monday that he is taking a malaria drug to lessen symptoms should he get the new coronavirus, despite warnings from his own government that it should only be administered in a hospital or research setting due to potentially fatal side effects. Trump told reporters he has been taking the drug, hydroxychloroquine, and a zinc supplement daily for about a week and a half now. Trump spent weeks pushing the drug as a potential cure for COVID-19 against the cautionary advice of many of his administration's top medical professionals. The drug has the potential to cause significant side effects in some patients and has not been shown to combat the new coronavirus. Trump said his doctor did not recommend the drug to him, but he requested it from the White House physician. "I started taking it because I think it's good," Trump said. "I've heard a lot of good stories." The Food and Drug Administration warned health professionals last month that the drug should not be used outside of hospital or research settings due to sometimes fatal side effects. Regulators issued the alert after receiving reports of heart rhythm problems, including deaths, from poison control centers and other health providers. In other developments, an experimental vaccine against the coronavirus showed encouraging results in very early testing, triggering hoped-for immune responses in 8 healthy middle-aged volunteers. Study volunteers given either a low or medium dose of the vaccine by Cambridge, Massachusetts-based Moderna, Inc., had antibodies similar to those seen in people who have recovered from COVID-19. More than 130,000 auto workers returned to factories across the U.S. for the first time in nearly 2 months Monday in one of the biggest steps yet to restart American industry. Detroit's Big Three, Fiat Chrysler, General Motors, and Ford, as well as Honda and Toyota, all had screening procedures in place at dozens of factories that reopened from the Great Lakes states south to Tennessee and Texas and out west at Tesla's factory near the San Francisco Bay. The coronavirus pandemic has created a huge need for healthcare in the U.S., but it also is delivering a devastating financial blow to that sector. COVID-19 worries have kept patients away from doctor's offices and forced the postponement and cancellation of non-urgent surgeries. Hospitals, health systems, and doctors have been forced to lay off staff, cut costs, and hope a return to normal arrives soon. Italy and the Vatican allowed the first public masses to be celebrated since March as coronavirus restrictions eased further following a sharp confrontation between church and state over limits on worshiping in the era of COVID-19. Guards in hazmat suits took the temperature of the faithful entering St. Peter's Basilica, where Pope Francis celebrated an early morning mass for a handful of people to commemorate the centenary of the birth of St. John Paul II. Chinese President Xi Jinping says China will provide $2 billion over 2 years to help with the response to the coronavirus pandemic. Xi's announcement by video conference at the start of the World Health Organization's annual assembly marks a sharp contrast to the United States. The Trump administration has announced a suspension of its funding for WHO over its alleged mishandling of the outbreak and praise of China's response. Just 1 week after a third of French schoolchildren went back to school in an easing of the coronavirus lockdown, there's been a worrying flare-up of about 70 COVID-19 cases linked to schools. Some schools were open last week, and 150,000 junior high students went back to the classroom Monday as further restrictions were loosened by the government. Service commemorates Meredith Willson's 118th birthday. Meredith Willson's famous 76 trombones won't be echoing down Mason City's streets this summer, but his birthday didn't pass without a salute to the city's native composer. Wilson, who was born May 18, 1902, is arguably most famous for writing the 1957 Broadway production The Music Man, also wrote the musical The Unsinkable Molly Brown, and the ubiquitous holiday song It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas. Wilson died in June 1984 at the age of 82. In a brief service Monday at the renovated Wilson family plot in Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery, Mason City High School's 2019-2020 drum majors, senior Bailey Gunderson and junior Shay Theobald, honored Wilson's life and legacy. The marching band leaders were recruited by band director Russ Kramer, and both students were happy to be involved. "I was super honored," Gunderson said. "I didn't even know this opportunity even existed, but I'm super glad to do it." "Same with me," said Theobald. "I was like, what? Oh my God, I'm so excited." The event, presented by the Mason City Chamber of Commerce, took place in the shadow of the recent news of the cancellation of this year's North Iowa Band Festival, which consists of a parade, carnival, and live entertainment held each Memorial Day weekend in downtown Mason City. Organizers made the decision last month amid concerns over the COVID-19 pandemic. This year marks the first time in over 80 years the festival will not be held. Iowa among leaders in response to 2020 census questionnaires. Iowans have the third highest self-response rate to the 2020 census, with 66.4% of households already completing their questionnaires. "Iowa is doing great, really well," John Cook of the U.S. Census Bureau told the Iowa Complete Count Committee on Monday. Iowa's self-response rate is running ahead of the national response rate of 59.5%, and 98 of the state's 99 counties have a response rate of at least 50%. Iowa is jostling with Minnesota, 69.5%, Wisconsin, 66.9%, Michigan, 66.2%, Nebraska, 66%, and Illinois, 64.5%, Cook said. "We've got a Big Ten matchup going here," said Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg, who leads the committee and noted his home county of Sioux is leading the state with a 73.7% self-response rate. In 2010, the final self-response rate for Iowa was 71%, according to the Census Bureau. This year is the first time households can complete the census questionnaire online. The census count has been slowed by the coronavirus pandemic. Field operations were shut down in mid-March, shortly after the committee last met, and shortly after the first COVID-19 cases were confirmed in Iowa. The Des Moines office is beginning to reopen this week, Cook said. Because of the coronavirus, the Bureau has pushed back its deadline for completing the 2020 count from the end of July to the end of October. The census impacts so much of everyday life, especially emergency situations like coronavirus, Greg said. The delay gives us an opportunity to drive up Iowa's initial response rate. Mandated by the Constitution, the decennial census is used to determine how many seats each state will get in the U.S. House of Representatives. Iowa is expected to retain its 4 congressional seats. The number is also used to apportion funding for numerous federal programs. In Iowa, that's about $9 billion in federal funds channeled through various programs, including food stamps and housing programs, Greg said. While praising Iowans' response, Maureen Schreiner of the Census Bureau reminded the committee that the third of Iowans left to count will be the hardest to reach. Including them in the count will take the participation of census partners, such as cities and various non-governmental organizations. The Census Bureau team presented a friendly competition for communities to increase their response rates. Cities of 5,000 people or fewer are challenged to get a 100% response rate. The goal for communities of 5,001 to 50,000 is to top their 2010 response rate by 5%. And cities of 50,001 and more have a goal of simply topping their 2010 response rate. Linn County has one of the leading response rates in Iowa, 70.4%. Johnson County is at 67.2%. County response rates can be found at 2020census.gov. Franklin County man takes to the water to elude police, gets fished out and arrested. A Hampton man has racked up a score of charges after leading law enforcement on a chase across Mason City and attempting to escape deputies by swimming across a popular fishing pit early Saturday morning. Around 1 a.m., a Cerro Gordo County Sheriff's deputy attempted to pull over a vehicle driven by 44-year-old Troy Lewis Wibke at the intersection of 4th Street Southwest and South Pierce Avenue when Wibke drove away at a high speed, according to a press release. A chase ensued throughout Mason City, ending with Wibke losing control and crashing his vehicle after driving along the westbound railroad tracks immediately north of Lester Milligan Park near 15th Street Southwest. Wibke fled on foot, entering the water of Black Pit and attempting to swim away. Deputies then had to rescue Wibke by swimming out and pulling him back to shore. No one was injured. Wibke was arrested on 9 separate charges: felony eluding, driving while barred, operating under the influence, driving under suspension, driving while revoked, failure to carry SR-22, possession of marijuana, third offense, possession of drug paraphernalia, and failure to appear in Floyd County, for which there was an open warrant. Wibke entered an initial plea of not guilty, and a trial date has been set for Monday, November 16th at 8 a.m. in Cerro Gordo County. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, May 18th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. At this time, we would normally turn to today's obituaries, but there are none, so we'll continue reading the news. Clear Lake Library, City Hall reopened to public. The Clear Lake Public Library and City Hall are reopening to the public this week after being closed due to COVID-19. The library opened Monday, and City Hall will open Tuesday, the city announced on its Facebook page Monday morning. The library, 200 North 4th Street, will be open limited hours from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. People are asked to wear masks and social distance while in the library. To comply with 50% capacity guidelines, all patrons are limited to 1 hour a day in the library. Children must be accompanied by an adult, and there won't be any toys, games, or puppets available in the children's department. For questions about the library, call 641-357-6133. City Hall, 15 North 6th Street, will be open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays. Only two customers will be allowed to enter the City Hall lobby area at a time and will be asked to observe social distancing of at least 6 feet from other people who are not behind the plexiglass window of the office clerk's counter. Visitors are asked to enter the building using the single front door and exit out the double doors. Additionally, visitors are encouraged to wear face masks and staff will routinely clean countertops. Most city services can be handled online or over the telephone, and residents are strongly encouraged to continue to use those options. Meetings with staff located at City Hall will be by appointment only. Residents who believe they must visit City Hall should call or email first to make sure the appropriate person is on site to assist them. For questions about City Hall, call 641-357-5267. MCPD reminds residents to keep tabs on pets. The Mason City Police Department issued a statement reminding residents to keep their pets' records and vaccinations up to date to prevent a trip to the pound. All dog and cat owners are required to ensure their animals are current on their rabies shots and city licenses. The mandate includes emotional support and service animals. According to the statement, animal control has seen an uptick in calls as the weather has become more mild, prompting law enforcement to reach out to pet owners in an effort to help them prevent extensive fines and the risk of their pet being taken to the animal shelter. The police department also warns that pets should be secured and supervised at all times, noting that an animal who bites someone or an animal at large may be impounded as well. Once a pet is impounded, ownership must be proven by the resident and any applicable fines must be paid in order for the animal to be released. Owners may also be issued criminal citations. Pet licenses may be obtained at the Mason City Animal Shelter and City Hall. Some veterinarians also provide licensing services. Those with questions may call Animal Control at 641-494-3560. What a Mason City homeless shelter has been doing during the COVID-19 pandemic. Right on the Center for Disease Control's website, there's a page that breaks down people who need to take extra precautions during the COVID-19 pandemic by listing various demographics. And so there's additional information for people with asthma, people who are immunocompromised, older adults, people with disabilities, and people experiencing homelessness. And as the page for that last group notes, because many people who are homeless are older adults or have underlying medical conditions, they may also be at higher risk for severe disease. It's precisely that sort of vulnerability that has an organization such as North Iowa's Northern Lights Alliance for the Homeless operating through the COVID-19 pandemic. It was quite obvious that homeless people would be dramatically impacted by COVID-19, so it was important to us that we could get people off of the streets and try and keep them safe and away from that possibility of being exposed, Northern Lights Executive Director Jeannie Kingery said. According to Kingery, the first big decision the organization had to make when shutdowns began in March was whether or not to even stay open. Some, such as a shelter in Sioux City, opted to temporarily close in March. Others, like Northern Lights, stayed open but with modifications for client intake and safety equipment use. Northern Lights' main priority became emergency clients or those who had no other place to go. And once in, residents had to wear masks in the common areas and any time they went out and came back in. That stopped for 5 weeks, however, when Northern Lights quarantined. During that time, residents were only allowed to go out for absolute essentials like food. Kingery said those precautions worked well and kept residents from harm. With the general concern she has for Northern Lights clients, Kingery said that she's particularly worried right now that people without a place to go could be forgotten at a time when there's so much for people to pay attention to. Even on the good day, there are a lot of people who don't realize we have a homeless population in North Iowa, she reflected. It's important for us to stay out there in the public and let them know we are here and we have clients that are more at risk than ever. One way that could manifest is a downturn in support. This time of year, Kingery said Northern Lights would normally have a spring fundraiser, but that's been pushed back to the fall. This was a big hit to the budget, as is the overall slow in donations, which Kingery thinks is owed to general financial uncertainty right now. Kingery also thinks that that slow in support could matter more in July when eviction moratoriums run out and those who haven't been able to pay rent because of financial upheaval are forced out of their homes. In Iowa, the renting population totals 790,918, according to Princeton University's Eviction Lab project, which means that an eviction rate in Iowa of even 2.3%, a rough national average, would result in 18,191 people being left without a home. "We haven't had anyone come in yet saying they've lost their job or can't pay rent," Kingery said. "But I'm kind of anticipating after July 25th, we're going to get really busy really fast." If that does happen, Kingery was clear about what Northern Lights would try to do. "We'll have to take in who we can." Fertile Restaurant featured an Iowa PBS show. A Fertile Restaurant will be on the Iowa PBS show Iowa Ingredient, showing off the restaurant and its use of ingredients only grown in Northern Iowa. When chefs Joshua Frederick and Nathaniel Frederick received an email a few weeks ago asking them to be on the show, which features farms and restaurants that grow and use local ingredients, they agreed and decided to feature asparagus, since that's coming into season in the area now. Joshua said they started getting asparagus just last week from Jeff Short in Garner, so he made an asparagus salad and grilled some asparagus for the TV show, which aired Thursday, May 7th at 6:30 p.m. The two cousins opened Cafe Mirror in August 2017 with a philosophy to use ingredients that are available locally to embody community and localism, Joshua said. "We want the money we're spending to go back to people in this area who have families, so just kind of this cycle of support," he said. Nathaniel said recently the desire to use local ingredients has become more of a fad, but for them it's more political and spiritual. "We believe that the farming industry has grown too large and doesn't really serve the people who are in need of this product, so that's just the basis of, I think, what the local food industry should be," he said. "It shouldn't be something that is just popular in certain circles." Joshua and Nathaniel grew up visiting their grandparents' farm, which raised everything from corn to hogs, every Sunday for their entire childhood. So they grew up with a sense of how things were before the massive boom of industrialized agriculture, they said. "Using only local ingredients, though, means the quantities and time certain produce is available changes throughout the year. So their menu changes every week, featuring different produce with the seasons. It's very seasonal, so I deal directly with all the produce growers and whatever they kind of have. That's what I do on the menu," Joshua said. The restaurant is open Friday and Saturday for dinner, so on Sunday, Joshua will get in contact with the local growers to see what they have available, and he'll start conceptualizing a menu for the weekend, which then gets posted on the restaurant's Facebook page on Wednesday. "Usually the whole thing doesn't change, but usually in the wintertime, maybe one thing a week. But in the summertime, you'll probably have 2 to 3 new things a week around there," Joshua said. Seasonal, fresh, rustic, and simple best describes and embodies the food they serve, which includes unique pizzas like Series of Dreams and Bangkok Blitz, salads, and lasagnas. "I kind of believe in sourcing really good ingredients and then not messing with them too much," Joshua said. "And it's very rustic. This isn't fussy food. It's pretty simple at its core." Because Cafe Mirror is in Fertile, a fairly small and remote town, there's little foot traffic to keep the restaurant open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner all week. So when Joshua and Nathaniel found the busiest times were the dinner hours on Fridays and Saturdays and Taco Tuesdays, they decided to limit their open hours to those times. That doesn't mean they're not busy running the restaurant for the rest of the week, though, since Joshua still plans the menu every week and Nathaniel is always taking reservations, according to Joshua. "Anyone who runs a small business knows if you're running it by yourself, you're running it 24/7, he said. The restaurant seats 45 people, and normally they would go through 2 full seatings on a typical Friday or Saturday. But now, because of the pandemic, they're doing strictly to-go orders. With an increase in volume of orders now, they are still keeping plenty busy, though the amount of money they're making is still less than usual because of the lack of alcohol sales, according to Joshua. "We just want to extend an appreciation, especially during this whole COVID-19 thing, to the local community for being so supportive and being so great, And I think during this time, we just really feel like it's a real symbiotic and reciprocal relationship that we have, where we're still putting out good food to people and we're here for them, and they've shown that they're here for us, Joshua said. The restaurant is open Friday and Saturday, 4 to 8 p.m., and has Taco Tuesday, 4 to 8 p.m. Virus may prompt more people to seek Morel's this spring. A year ago, Steve Roberts and Todd Whitman, both of Ankeny, scored nearly 50 pounds of Morel mushrooms together in a single day. The last time Roberts said he made a comparable bounty was 25 years ago, when he was just 18. On this day, a cool and cloudy end to a long stretch of sunshine, Morel hunters weren't so lucky. Even with ideal temperatures, a relatively dry April has delayed the peak growth of morels, a wild fungi with ridges that resemble honeycomb. Conditions for spring mushroom hunting should improve slightly thanks to rain forecast across Iowa early last week, making way for what could be a particularly busy morels season. As the coronavirus pandemic forces people to stay home and maintain social distance in public, more people are spending time in nature, experts say. Jim Coffey, a forest wildlife research biologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, said more Iowans are hunting turkeys, fishing, and using parks compared to last spring, one silver lining of daily routines being uprooted by COVID-19. I think people are getting out and exploring a little bit more and maybe getting back to the roots of things they used to do back when life wasn't as busy as they thought, now that we have a little more free time, he told the Des Moines Register. Roberts, who runs the popular Iowa Morel Report Facebook page for 35,000 followers, dedicates hours of every day each spring to his lifelong hobby. The 43-year-old husband and father is also the owner of Pie 5 Pizza in Ankeny. I think it's awesome, he said, of the bump in popularity of mushrooming. He has closely monitored the same patch of land twice a day for almost 2 weeks, gauging the conditions and any growth. His father, Ron, often accompanies him, which is further built upon his decades of experience. My grandfather taught my dad, and my dad taught me, said Roberts. He taught me how to mushroom hunt, and now I'm teaching him a little bit. It's great to have someone take over, his dad said last week. But there's more mushrooms than just morels out there to hunt. Like morels or morchella, yellow oyster mushrooms also grow in spring. And in the fall, hen of the woods mushrooms are easier to find and taste just as good or better, said Roberts, who also runs the Iowa Fall Mushroom Report Facebook page. People who sell their mushroom bounties, for which a certification is required, are facing more issues than dry soil. Because of the pandemic, Iowa State University Extension and Outreach canceled its program for new certifications for morel and oyster sales, although recertifications are still available. Brant Fox and his business partner, Mike Mayer, run Honey Hole Morel Mushrooms, and the two plan to sell their product at the downtown farmers market in Des Moines for the first time this year. They purchase mushrooms from pickers in Iowa and across the continental United States. Their business is facing new challenges from COVID-19. Older pickers are not out as much, Fox guessed, because of recommended precautions for elderly people. Popular events such as food festivals are being canceled, and the downtown farmers market is being held virtually for now. My partner and I really don't know what direction this is going to go, said Fox, who lives in rural Mingo. He said that if the farmers market reopens outdoors this year, it's not going to be like it was, with thousands of people walking around listening to live music and smiling. It's going to be people wearing face masks and being concerned about the quality of the food and how it's being handled. Still, Fox is seeing increased demand for his morels. I never thought I would say this, but in the midst of this COVID-19 dilemma, we are seeing a lot of interest in fresh foods. We have more people interested in buying from us now than probably ever before, he said. Morels typically pop in southern Iowa in early April, then move north until mid-May as soil temperature and moisture increase, Coffey said. For newcomers and veterans alike, the key to finding them is patience. Roberts' advice for mushroom hunters is to not get discouraged, even if morels are covered by long grass and weeds. A lot of people give up, and then I find them 2 or 3 weeks later, said Roberts, who often donates his morels to friends. Coffey recommends that hunters with varying experience levels buddy up and explore south-facing hills and the perimeters of woodlands, both of which get lots of sunlight. It also helps to study photos of morels before you hunt, as your brain will more easily spot them, he said. Assuming parts of Iowa get an inch of rain early this week, as the National Weather Service predicts, this week will be a pretty good time to be out, he said. Iowa farmers nearly complete corn-soybean planting. Thanks to favorable weather, Iowa farmers have planted most of the corn crop and are nearing completion of soybean planting, the U.S. Department of Agriculture reported Monday. The USDA said in the week ending Sunday, farmers had planted 96% of the expected corn crop, putting them nearly a month ahead of last year and almost 3 weeks ahead of the five-year average. Farmers had planted 86% of the soybean crop, also nearly a month ahead of last year and three weeks earlier than the average. They were helped by good weather that made for 4.3 days suitable for field work. Group seeks money to bury refugee 36 who died of COVID-19. Advocates are raising money for the burial of a 36-year-old Congolese refugee who died of the coronavirus earlier this month in Des Moines. Embark Iowa, a refugee services organization, said that Wiyuka Iti Wiyuka died May 4th after a sudden illness and 2 weeks in the hospital. The group says advocates need to raise thousands of dollars to have Wiyuka buried this week at an Ankeny cemetery. Traditional burial in the Congolese community is extremely important. There is no other option. Since the body came from the soil, it must be returned, the group says. Wiyuka leaves behind two adult siblings who, like him, were resettled to Des Moines last year from a refugee camp in Tanzania. They had fled war in Congo in 1996. Wiyuka's siblings have been struggling to pay their rent and expenses and have been off work, Embark Iowa says. A pastor who has worked with the family says all three siblings were employed at a Pitney Bowes warehouse, but it's unknown where Wiyuka contracted the virus. Wiyuka is at least the second Congolese refugee to die in Iowa of coronavirus in recent days. On May 10th, the Congolese community in Waterloo announced that Tyson Foods employee Axel Kabea died of COVID-19. Goodwill announces closure of stores in central Iowa. As businesses across the state are beginning to reopen, Goodwill of Central Iowa has announced plans to permanently close four retail stores as well as a career center. The nonprofit organization said last week it had permanently closed stores in Grinnell, Oskaloosa, Waukee, and South Des Moines because of financial hardship of restrictions imposed in an effort to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Goodwill has opened stores in Ames, Ankeny, Des Moines, Johnston, Indianola, Marshalltown, Ottumwa, Urbandale, and two stores in West Des Moines. The organization also has closed the South Des Moines Outlet and Career Connection Center. Goodwill said in a news release that the need to close stores in March, April, and part of May has been especially difficult because it receives 80% of its funding through retail sales. Padati, this is exactly the kind of work that I want to do. A pediatrician by trade, one of the things that drew Caitlin Padati to public health service was the ability to address health issues on a larger scale. As much as I loved medicine, and I do, I loved taking care of kids, it did feel like I was seeing some of the same problems again and again, Padati said this week, and it made me think of ways I could address more people at once. Padati now is one of the central figures in the effort to protect more than 3 million Iowans during a global pandemic. Dr. Caitlin Padati is Iowa's state epidemiologist and medical director for the state public health department. The 34-year-old Padati has become a vitally important and very public figure in the weeks since the new coronavirus was first detected in Iowa in early March. Padati provides the public health department's guidance to Governor Kim Reynolds and regularly appears with the governor at her daily briefings. The scope of the pandemic, caused by the new coronavirus and COVID-19, the disease it causes, is unlike any since a worldwide influenza outbreak more than a century ago. As of Friday, more than 300,000 people worldwide and nearly 88,000 Americans had died from the disease. Iowa had recorded 336 deaths as of Friday. Padotti and the Public Health Department's work has helped inform Reynolds as the governor has made myriad critical decisions, including to temporarily shut down schools and many businesses, and more recently, when to begin relaxing some of those restrictions. To hear Padotti and those who know her well describe it, she is in the right place at the right time. As challenging and as unfortunate as this whole virus has been, Padotti said, this is exactly the kind of work that I want to do and the way I want to be useful in public health. Dr. Janine Moody is an instructor in Des Moines University's public health program and a former executive director of the Iowa Public Health Association. In her former role, Moody was on the team that interviewed candidates for the state epidemiologist opening when Padotti was hired. Moody said she was impressed by Padotti's varied experiences in both clinical medicine and public health, and found Padotti to be an excellent communicator. They are all attributes that serve Padotti well as she helps attempt to manage a global pandemic, Moody said. She's legit and uniquely qualified, Moody said. I know that she is young, but I know that she has unique qualifications that have prepared her really well. Dr. Patricia Quinlisk was the state epidemiologist before Padotti. Quinlisk retired in 2018 after serving 24 years in the position under both Republican and Democratic governors. Quinlisk praised Padotti's work during the COVID-19 pandemic, saying only that it's unfortunate Padotti was forced to face the pandemic at an early stage in her career. Obviously, we wouldn't have hired her. She wouldn't have been the one if we did not think she could do this job, Quinlisk said. I think Caitlin's doing a great job, but I do feel sorry that this is coming so early in her career, not later in her career. Padotti said she is intrigued by the disease detective work involved in public health, a curiosity that would seem handy during a pandemic that features a new disease for which there is no vaccine. I really enjoy working in a situation where we can be flexible and come up with creative ways to help people. Those were the kinds of things I wanted to do in a broad way, Padotti said. Whether we're talking about COVID, vaping, hypertension, Zika virus, or anything else, there's a breadth of work and a lot of things that affect people's health on a day-to-day basis. And I really love being able to look at that range of things and look at what the population that I serve needs and how can we get them what they need. That was not always the case. Padotti said growing up in Northern Virginia, she always wanted to be a doctor. She would get excited, she said, when one of her two sisters was sick because she liked tagging along to see the doctor. She went to medical school and became a board-certified and licensed pediatrician. But while getting her undergraduate degree at Georgetown University, she also started learning about public health, in part at the behest of some of her professors. And one of her first projects as a student, she said, was helping Virginia's Arlington County develop pandemic response plans. The project was to imagine a pandemic like an influenza outbreak and develop response plans for healthcare settings and businesses. That was my first experience with what population health or public health meant, Padotti said. While Padotti said she could not have foreseen that she would be on the front lines of a state's response to a global pandemic, that project from early in her education illustrates how epidemiologists prepare for outbreaks. I don't know that I could have quite exactly predicted this, that's for sure, but I do think people in our field, we've talked about this for years, and we really do a lot of planning and thinking about ways that we can be ready for situations like this, Padotti said. Quinlisk said epidemiologists not only prepare for future outbreak, they study outbreaks of the past. She said she even remembers asking her grandmother about the 1918 flu pandemic. I think you always know in the back of your mind it's possible just because you look at history. When you study epidemiology, you study history, Quinlisk said. So you know that those things can happen. But I don't know that you ever think that it's going to be as global as this is. In addition to making Padotti's work even more critical, the COVID pandemic has made her work more public. She regularly appears with Reynolds at the governor's daily briefings on the state's pandemic response. Those briefings are broadcast on television and the internet. Padotti said she feels it is critically important to convey the department's goals and strategies to the public. She said she understands that there are critics of some of the state's response strategies and that she welcomes those viewpoints as well. I want the people to know about what we do and how we do it and why we do it, she said. Padotti joked that she even found one critic back in Northern Virginia. Padotti said her mother told her that she needed to stop praising every question from the reporters at the daily briefings. Moody praised Padotti's communication skills. She said Padotti has showed that she can be an intent listener and provide a helpful answer without overwhelming people with medical jargon. She's a good listener. I think that serves her really well in this moment, Moody said. You have to communicate the science of your head and you have to communicate with your heart. Padotti said the new coronavirus has presented a unique challenge because it is new and more is being learned about it daily. She said the state's response effort has been a collaborative approach between the state public health department, fellow public health officials at the local and federal level, other state agencies, and the state's medical community. Asked for her message to Iowans during the pandemic, Padotti said while it may sound simplistic, her goal is to determine how best to protect and improve the public's health. I just want to reiterate my commitment, and certainly the department's commitment, to doing everything we possibly can to stop the spread of this illness and keep everybody as safe and healthy as we can, Padotti said. And I appreciate this has been an unprecedented and challenging time for everybody who has been affected in different ways. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, May 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakegrose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.